From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the June edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. We'll hear from a woman who worked in the Secret Intelligence Service during World War II and took the time to tell me about it when she paid a visit to Bletchley Park to fill in the gaps. We'll take you back in time at the 40s Family Festival, getting into the spirit of the decade, with everything from authentic weaponry to undergarments, and we'll meet the fascinating people involved in the British Resistance Archive. But first, we brave the elements to bring you bang up to date on the restoration of Bletchley Park. The £7.4 million heritage lottery-funded restoration of Bletchley Park is now well underway. So we thought we'd take a walk in the rain with site manager Rob Davis from FWA. Now, what does FWA stand for, Rob?
Fairhurst Ward Abbots, yeah. We're specialists in conservation and restoration.
And buildings. So you've been into all the buildings and made a really good start. Let's find out what's been going on. So we're outside huts 6 and 3, which still look a bit tired, but look like there's some TLC going on. So you're in there, and what have you found?
Just in the process of trying to make the building safe now. I mean, I think we've got it just in the nick of time. I think the elements have been getting into some of these buildings for quite some time, and the roofs are starting to decay, the plasterboard's starting to fall in. So in some instances, it'll just be to repair and restore just to save the buildings in some places. And in others, we're going to be taking off all the existing cement cladding and putting them new. The sole plates are all rotten in places. There's a lot of rotten floorboards. So there's going to be an extensive structure works to repair the perimeter structure of the building and re-roofing the building to stop the water coming in.
What's this about hut 3 floating?
Well, as we ripped off some of the carpets, we had to get the structural engineer here for the day to look at the sole plate and how we were going to do the repair works. And we pulled back some of the carpet in one of the rooms and we found that the sole plate had gone completely and half the hut was just hanging in the air. So we had to do a little emergency repair by putting a new sole plate in and just cramping on another piece of timber onto the rafters and extending it through onto the sole plate so we could just get some support back into the hut.
So what do you mean hanging in the air? It must have been connected
Well, if you imagine that the rafters were connected to the uprights of the walls, so that was literally what was pretty much holding it in place. So the rest of the structure was there. It's just in one area at the base of the wall was not touching anything. In a lot of places, because the sole plate is gone, there's been a lot of subsidence and the floors are starting to fall in. So that's what, fortunately, we're going to repair, and not a moment too soon, I would say, in some places.
It's amazing that they're actually still standing, isn't it? They weren't built to last.
No, not at all. And you can tell they went up pretty quickly. Well, because they had to, and they were practical. I can't say they're the nicest places to live in, but, you know, I'm sure they kept them dry. The huts themselves, we won't be changing much to them. We're just trying to restore them and make them safe again for people to go and have a look at.
It does make you think about what an odd thing history is, that we're fascinated to go inside these buildings and we've had this desperate race to save them because they're so important historically. Mm. Can you imagine what the people who threw them together would make of us standing here now?
They'd probably be quite proud, though, thinking about it, because, I mean, one of the great things working here is to be part of the story of Bletchley Park and telling the story of Bletchley Park. Because I don't think it has been really told in its entirety, and that's what we're trying to do. And I think the people that built it, if they knew their work was being saved, I'm a carpenter myself. If I know something I'd built, you know, 70 years ago was being restored and kept, I'd be immensely proud, I think, to know that was happening. Well, we're just stood on top of Spurs 7, 8 and 9 now. This is the area we've put the temporary roof over, and we've spanned one third of Flock C. This is the only area we've actually done the temporary roof over, because this is where most of the water ingress and damage has happened to the roof, and we've got a lot of water and roots growing down through into the building. Because the rest of the roof is actually in pretty good condition, and we can work on those areas piece by piece and repair them in small sections. Whereas in Spurs 7, 8 and 9, what we needed to do is get the entire roof uncovered so we could dry it out quickly, so as to keep on with our programme really, and dry the building out, ready to put back again. The roof is going to be going back as a felt roof, as it was. The only thing that will be slightly different, just to keep everyone a bit warmer inside, because they didn't think much about insulating buildings in those days, is that we were putting 120mm insulation underneath the felt roofing. Now we've got the roof over and we're stood up here, you wouldn't really think you were on top of a roof, because we've got some quite mature trees and shrubs growing on top of the roof now, and you'd think you were stood in the glasshouse of Kew Gardens. Yeah, not a good greenhouse, let's say that much. You'd probably be a bit disappointed with what you've grown, but it's an interesting place to be.
So we're now right at the far end where this was damp roof. This wasn't...
The Spurs 7, 8 and 9, this is where we're stripping. This is why we've covered it over, because obviously it was the area that got most damp. We've stripped the whole lot off to help this end dry out. But to be honest, we thought it would be quite difficult drying it out. But what's happened is the building was originally designed the way it was because there's a lot of cross ventilation. That's why it's designed in this spider shape, apparently. But it makes sense. You get more light and cross ventilation to the whole building. So what we've done is, by taking all the walls out, is you've actually... it's gone back to its original design. So since taking all the wet carpet out and all the wet gypsum off the walls and opening everything up, there's natural ventilation that's come through now, and actually everything's drying out pretty quickly. We're a lot less concerned than we were. I'm not saying there's still a lot of drying out to do. There is, because I mean, I think that these slabs have been getting wet. But since 1987, it was a bit vacated.
So with this temporary roof we've got over here, just give us an idea of how unusual that is.
Well, I mean, the whole thing is designed specifically for the job. It's not just like you just buy it off the shelf.
So it's unusual, it's unique, basically.
It's been made especially for this job, and the actual covering for it is bespoke to this roof. You couldn't normally just go the normal straight beam across to cover it over because it's too much bigger span, so it has to be a pitch detail to do that much span. And also what it's going to allow is a lot of light and ventilation over the top of the roof to just let air through as well. What it does is it allows us that huge area then to cover that whole roof without having to move any scaffolding or anything. It gives us a big area to work on, so...
It's no longer pigeon's paradise in here.
Yeah, they're just sticking with us a bit. They don't want to move out yet. But though they started trying now to move into my office. I had one flying to the office the other day.
Oh, no. So this was a living roof as well at the back. So how did you tackle that?
What we found out, we started stripping the roof coverings off yesterday. We were wondering what the root system was like. There's the odd root coming through the roof, as you can see here. The root system's actually just spread across the roof itself. So what we're finding is that when you're actually stripping the roof off, all the root system's actually underneath all the roofing felt. There's some quite mature trees up there.
How bizarre, you wouldn't think they would grow that well. So it must have been quite difficult to actually get into some of the far reaches at the back end. Can you tell me what that was like?
To demolish?
Yeah.
Well, we started off trying to take the walls out, deconstruct the walls by hand. That meant guys on towers and handbreakers and stuff, just taking out sections at a time with lump hammers. And the walls were, even though they were a single skin wall, were extremely tough. And to be honest, it would have taken the guys a long time, and it was becoming difficult, and we were worried it was just going to take forever.
So bomb-proof.
Exactly. I think they had more cement than they had sand in those days. So after 2 days of trying that, we thought, well, this isn't working, so we need to look at another way of taking these walls out sensibly and safely and quickly and without causing minimum damage. Of course, there's lots of machinery out there you can use for demolition, but it's often diesel-powered or petrol-powered. Of course, you can't use that inside a space like this. So we looked into a Brock 90. This is electric-powered, so you can use it indoors. One guy working it remotely, and it's on tracks, and it's just got a breaker on the end of it, and it's got a robotic arm, and it was able to pick out and take out all the walls, and one guy working on it all day on his own. He could even pick out the bricking in that had been done in between the steels. It was done post-war.
I'm picturing something like in Titanic when they sent those submersibles down and they're feeling around in the wreck.
It's something very similar, you know. I don't know how I'd describe it. I mean, if you imagine like a mini digger.
It sounds pretty
almost
cool.
A mini digger.
Were you fighting a robot to play with it?
Unfortunately, you have to be qualified to drive it, yeah. I did want to go, but yeah. You went through the place in about 7 days. So every day you would come in and another spur would be open and another view of the building was seen. And it was an exciting week, actually.
So we're starting to see now the layout as it actually was.
Well, for the first time ever, I mean, in so many years, you can now see from one end of Block C to the other.
And daylight,
yeah.
Which is incredible.
And, you know, we had a few exciting finds. We found a red cross painted on one of the piers that we can only assume was a first aid point. I've also written in red paint was fire, so it must have been a fire point. We assume that's where some of the paint's flaking off. And we found some of the original fixtures and fittings, some of the original brackets that hold some of the mechanical and the original heating pipes that ran through the building were buried in some of the brick walls that we took out. It's quite a view now, yeah. So we're now starting to look at putting everything back now. So we've got brickwork to repair. We're going to have shot blasters starting next week. They're going to start shot blasting all the walls back to the brick to get off all the old paintwork and stuff so we can redecorate.
When you look at the girders, they look like they're rusting.
To be honest, considering how much water's been getting in there and everything's in very good condition, she's a strong old girl. One of the fears was when we start taking the walls out is had these internal walls become structural walls, even though they weren't, have they become structural walls? But what it turned out was that we had no issues at all with anything. When we started taking the walls out, everything was very sound. It's only surface rust. That will then be shot blasted off, and then the steels will be reprimed, and they're in remarkably good condition, to be honest. What's in slightly more disrepair metal-wise is some of the metal frame windows, which will need a bit more care and attention.
How exciting is it for you to get sort of first view of this?
Do you know, funny enough, it's actually quite a modern building for me to work on in this grand scheme of things. You know, I've worked on 15th century, 16th century. So normally I wouldn't equate these sort of buildings to be that exciting to work on, but there's a completely different element to this and the history behind it. Yeah, it's a huge honour. And to be one of the first people to see this building and putting it back to how it was, it's fantastic.
The home of the Codebreakers played host to more reenactors than ever before at its busiest ever 40s family festival over the bank holiday weekend. People of all ages packed the park in and out of period costume, taking part in activities and performances, or just soaking up the atmosphere. Podcast producer Mark Cotton was there.
And deep as a river, come rain or come shine.
You're getting to be a bit of a regular here, aren't you?
When I come here, it is a 40s weekend, so I do the 40s singing. I do sing anything from the 1920s right up to now, and some of the stuff you will see in my 40s sets is pre-1940s. But they always enjoy it, get some up dancing.
Last time we saw you, Luna, was at last year's Veterans Weekend, I think. Is that right?
It is correct, yeah.
We used a lovely piece of you leading the veterans in a sing-song just before the service that was held on the Sunday, which they always do for the Veterans Weekend. Any plans for the Veterans Weekend this year?
I would absolutely love to come along again this year. I particularly love it when the veterans come in and they say, oh, I remember that. It's wonderful. I met so many wonderful veterans and, of course, their family as well last year. But there was one lady in particular. I was so enthralled with the story she was telling me. I didn't get her name, unfortunately. But she asked me, as I was leading the sing-along that you mentioned, if I knew a certain song called A Lovely Way to Spend an Evening by Vera Lynn. And I said, I don't, you know. And I've actually never heard of that one before. She said they used to sing it when they were going on watch of a night. So I said, well, I'll tell you what. I promise you I will learn it if you promise to come back next year. Cheeky as she was, she said, I can't make any promises, but I will try and be here next year. So I went away. I couldn't find the backing track, but what I do is I perform it a cappella. It's actually on my second album, and I'd love to be here. I'd love to see her again. I'd love to perform that just for her.
Do you think this style of singing and older songs are becoming more popular with people now?
Definitely. I mean, my husband's been doing this for 20 years now, but when I started this, probably four years ago now, there was hardly anything. There was hardly any singers on the scene. There was hardly any events to go to. Now you're clashing every weekend. You know, do I go here? Do I go there?
So you're getting plenty of work this way?
Oh, definitely. I think I've got 2 weekends free for the rest of this year, and I've already got 5 bookings for next.
How can people find out more about you? Are you online?
I am, yes. I do have a website. I'm, of course, on Facebook under the name Luna Nightingale. I do have a website, which is misslunanightingale.co.uk. Chances are you will see me at an event somewhere, though, and you can always contact me through anywhere that I am.
And we'll see you again at Bletchley Park, I've no doubt. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. Today we're here to represent the Auxiliary Home Guard. Everybody's heard about Dad's Army and the Home Guard. An army of volunteers, of old men and young boys who were prepared to lay down their lives if necessary, defending the country with a carving knife strapped to the end of a broom handle. Well, they weren't the only Home Guard. There was another form of Home Guard, the Auxiliary Home Guard, who were far better trained and were given much better equipment.
My name's Tom Sykes from the Coleshill Auxiliary Research Team. We run a website called the British Resistance Archive. And it's basically an archive of research material connected to the auxiliary units and Churchill's British Resistance.
It's a story not a lot of people know about, is it? That had we been invaded by the Germans in 1940, there were these people ready to stay behind and fight.
All the volunteers that were involved signed the Official Secrets Act, and a lot of them took it to their graves with them, so they're not really... They haven't spoken much since then. We've got about 13 researchers around the country that are actively researching the Yorkshire units. There was 672 patrols around the country, and they were made up of volunteers, farm owners, poachers, landowners, and they were managed by the military. Basically, when we were invaded, they would go to ground, they'd live in underground bunkers, and they'd let the Germans pass overhead, and they'd come out and cause as much damage and sabotage as possible to reduce the speed of the German advance, basically. They were guerrilla warfare.
And basically, they knew they were going to get killed.
Yeah, they had a life expectancy, realistically, of probably about 12 days. They had rations for 12 days. Because they were living off the land, because they knew the land so well, they tended to, obviously, they were able to live off the land and poach and things, so they could have probably gone a lot longer than that. But realistically, they were signing up to a suicide mission.
And what are you hoping to do with the archive? Just to bring it more to people's attention, or...?
Well, we've currently researched 50% of the UK, and we put patrol reports together that look at individual patrols. And it's all published on our website, and our plan is to cover as much of the UK as possible. The priority is to speak to as many auxiliaries as possible before they die, and to get their accounts of what's happened. And in the future, we may well look at making a connection with the Imperial War Museum or the National Archives.
And have you got a website where people can find out more information?
Everything's on our website, which is staybehinds.com.
Thank you very much.
We too, that is us, would like to, what would we like to do?
Don't you remember?
Don't I remember? Of course I remember. I'm just checking that you remember.
Oh, I remember.
Good.
We're doing a potted history of World War II.
Oh, yes, I remember it well.
Great, shall we enlighten the audience then?
Yes, where shall we begin?
Let's start at the very beginning.
Yeah, very good place to start.
You'd better get a move on then.
Oh, yes, okay.
So, chaps, here we are, back in September 1939. I say, gang, isn't that Neville Chamberlain, Prime Minister of Great Britain?
This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently, this country is at war with Germany.
And so, moving on to May the 19th, 1940, and I think it's Winston who's got something to say now.
Having received His Majesty's commission, I have formed a new administration of men and women of every party and almost every point of view. We have differed and quarrelled in the past, but now one bond unites us all, to wage war until victory is won, and never surrender ourselves to servitude and shame, whatever the cost and the agony may be.
So, life in Britain underwent an immediate change.
Many children were evacuated out of the cities, not knowing where their journeys would take them, and rationing was introduced.
Whale meat was added to the menu.
Oh, whale meat again?
No. And so, Britain, with Winston Churchill at its head, was approaching the end of the Phoney War. And with the British Expeditionary Force already stationed in France, expectations were cautious, but high.
Put your thumbs up and say tickety-boo, cause tickety-boo means everything will be fine. You'll always wear a smile.
You're talking to Robert Radford.
And Catherine De Vere.
Marvellous. It's like we've just come off the stage of doing Dodging the Doodlebugs here at Bletchley Park.
Is that the smallest stage you've ever performed on?
It certainly would be up there with the smallest. Yeah, we've managed to use half our staging
normal,
today.
Yeah. So hopefully nobody saw my underpants.
Yes, hopefully. There was a lot of standing very close together or standing on other people's shoulders going on backstage.
It was what was happening with the trombone player, I don't know.
Let's not ask that. Yeah. Let's not ask. It's inappropriate.
That was an absolutely brilliant performance.
Thank
it's
you.
So quick fire. It's just how you guys remember it all, I do not know. You do this professionally full time, don't you?
Yes, we're professional actors, so we've been doing this ever since leaving drama school, and we've obviously worked together for a very long time, which is obviously why what you see on stage is a little bit of our real life, basically.
Why not? Well, we've got no excuses for getting it wrong.
No, that's true. We've got no excuses for getting it wrong.
Yes. We sort of call it a potted history of World War II. So we start at the beginning and we finish at the end. But it's all done in 30 to 35 minutes.
We like to think it's a 1940s comedy sketch show.
Yes.
But we will certainly keep ourselves and hopefully the audience on their toes.
Where can people contact you?
Well, we have our website.
Which is?
The three W's.
Which is the three W's.
And then heydayspresents.com. And then on there is all the details.
Or you can contact us by checking us out and liking us on Facebook.
Yes, it's modern technology.
Petrolhead Heaven approaches at Bletchley Park with the annual Classic Car and Motorbike Picnic on Sunday the 30th of June. All shapes and sizes of classic vehicles pack the park each year, and there's a hefty discount if you bring one along. It costs £12 per classic car, including everyone in it, and just £6 per motorbike. For that price, you get a year-long season ticket and a guided tour. Bletchley Park was the hub of a far wider network during World War II. We have the honour of welcoming veterans not only who worked here, but also at the many outstations and occasionally another part of the intelligence services. Back in the summer, I met Marjorie Nichols, whose maiden name was Hardwick. She worked for MI6 at Broadway, and she was fascinated to find out what actually went on at BP.
It would be about 1943. I was posted up to Godmanchester, where we used to house people to be dropped over in France, which was quite good fun and quite interesting. Then I was posted back to London, to Broadway. So that would be about late 43, 44. Then I worked in the teleprinters. Now, we were a whole lot of WAF there. So we would receive messages. They would come up and say it was either a message for the Air Ministry or Admiralty, War Office, or all three. And then we would switch over and the message would go through to those particular people. Sometimes it was a message purely and simply for MI6, so we would have to receipt it. Sometimes it was a special message for Churchill, and we had to type that on a typewriter, so it was all very nice for him to go and send it across. Also, we had a different teleprinter for the Americans, and that used to come over in code, and we used to have to type it back in code then to the Americans. I don't know why it couldn't be sent direct to them, for some reason or other, but I quite enjoyed typing those out. And that really is it. Can't think of much else.
Well, you say that's it, but it sounds like you were actually quite well informed about what was going on.
Well, yes and no. Just as the chappie was saying here, Hutt this, didn't know what Hutt that was doing. That's us. Now, this is why it's been very, very interesting to me, because we were getting messages in, but I had no idea really of what was going on here. In fact, it was only when I was reading the book that I knew all about it, because everything has to be kept in little things, you know,
compartmentalized.
Yes, because you would be working in head office and then you get a posting overseas, and you get overseas and you would meet somebody. You say the only way you knew them was because you'd seen them in the cloakroom, and you say, oh, you're out here, are you? But other than that, you know, you never knew, you never told anybody where you were going or anything like that.
Can you tell me where you went now?
Germany was my first posting. Then I went to Cyprus. Then I was married because, yes, I had met my husband by then. He was in the signals side. And then we went to Singapore with one small boy, and then Hong Kong. Then we went up to Norfolk working with the Americans. Then we went back to Cyprus and we came back from there. And he was posted to Gloucester to work with 602 Troop at Robinswood. Gloucester had been my first posting as a WAF, and I had said, never again do I want to come back here. And where do I end my days? Here, in Gloucester.
What was it about Gloucester that you didn't like?
Oh, I don't know. It was just people weren't very friendly to service people, you know. And no, I didn't like it. It was a very uninteresting thing, doing records.
Well, certainly less interesting than your war work.
Yes, it was much more interesting once I got to London.
Did you have a feeling that you were right in the thick of it at the sharp end at the time, or was, you know, the chain of information so limited that you only had a tiny piece of the jigsaw?
Well, it's true that we did only have a bit of the jigsaw, but as I was saying, there would always be messages when the V1s dropped. My parents were living down in Guildford and I'd been down to visit them, and a V1 had dropped and the trains were on. So I was late getting in. Now, I was thinking, oh, I'll have to say to them, oh, I'm sorry, but it was my train. But they knew because they'd got the reports of whatever anywhere dropped, you know, which, had, of course, had come from here.
I'm going to get you back to basics. And from 1943, you were at Broadway and you were disseminating information that had come from Bletchley Park.
Bletchley Park, yes.
But you only knew it was BP?
Yes, knew it was Bletchley Park, but it was always called BP, and on the bottom of the teleprinter messages, you had to put who received it. You know, you put RD, BP, and then MMH. That was my initials then.
Was it difficult to accept the lifting of the veil in the 70s and from then on, the level of secrecy sort of dissipating?
Not really. The little man sort of put the fear of God into you when he was getting you to sign the Official Secrets Act. And it was only when the book came up that I had said where I had worked. I was given it by my granddaughter for Christmas. And when I read in there, and they were talking all about Broadway, and they were talking about Freddie Winterbottom, and I, gosh, there's my boss, you know. And I thought, well, if they can say all this, why do I have to keep it all to myself?
Your son's here. Can I bring you in on this conversation? Hello, what's your name?
Philip.
So you must have got a surprise when you learned what your mum had done.
Yes, because she did. She kept it very quiet. As children, we didn't know anything about it. It's only in the last few years that she's talked about it. And my wife and I moved to Leighton Buzzard, and we've been up here years ago. And then my mum was up here this week, so we thought we'd bring her up.
And it must be a treasure trove of family history. I mean, I think a lot of people live to regret not having found out more about what their relatives did in the war.
Well, I suppose so, but then it's very difficult. I mean, when you're sort of told not to say anything, keep mum. And during the war, you knew the telephone was not secret. Nothing was... You just had to mind what you were saying all the time. I don't know if you know Broadway, but our Broadway building was right opposite St James Park too. But somebody said to me afterwards, the little man that used to stand on the corner selling the newspapers... He photographed us all going in and out. Whether that was true or whether somebody was just saying, I don't know. But it could very easily, because I know on D-Day when we came off duty, you know, it had come in the early hours of the morning, we came off duty and went to the Abbey. And as we went past, he turned around and said, oh, it started, hasn't it? How did he know?
He wasn't just a newspaper seller, was he?
No, I don't think he was. It was just in a good spot.
You must have had to suspect everyone.
Well, I think you did, really, because one of our WAF officers in her flat, she knew that there was a chap that used to pass her on the stairs with his hat right down and never said anything. But she could hear through her wardrobe Morse code. She reported it. Our guys went there and found a spy there next door to her.
I'm going to be nosy now. Can you remember any information that you would remember? Because there must have been such a constant stream of messages.
Absolutely. All day and every day. I mean, there were files and files of messages. But it was all coming from Admiral Dönitz. I can't remember the names of the other blokes, but I don't know why that one stuck in my mind.
Did you type up the messages for Churchill? Because you've mentioned that.
Yes, you did. Yes, yes. That was when you got the headlines. You had to retype those for him, yeah.
And I mean, it must have been only the most important information that went to him.
Yes, I think it was something special that they wanted him to know. But
is there anything that you recall?
What it was now.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time while you were here today.
Well, I hope there's some useful bits.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @BParkPodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.